From Buck Studio at Wisconsin Public Radio, this is Zorba Pastor on Your Health. I'm Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor, here to talk with you about what's new in healthy living, share some down-to-earth advice, and some great lifestyle tips to help you get the most out of life. If you have a question for Zorba, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And as always, along with your calls, some interesting topics to talk about.
Yes, barefoot running style, is it best for you? What about a new scientific study that looks at that versus traditional running with regular shoes?
Okay,
and designated drivers often drink. So are they really designated drivers? What does that mean for our society? And what does that mean for our safety? Let's talk about that, some new research.
We're going to talk about kids drinking, too.
Yes, absolutely.
And our recipe.
Yes, Zorba's. We have a guest chef today. It's Zorba Pastor, and we're discussing Zorba's vanilla extract, and it's a wonderful vanilla extract that you will want to make yourself.
Yeah, I believe that. We talk about vanilla extract a lot on this show with recipes. Now we get your recipe.
Yes, my recipe. Extract. I am the guest chef today, so that means I interview me. I don't quite understand that, but something of that nature.
We, of course, have a medical myth buster coming on later in the hour. To the phones we go now, Zorba, welcoming a listener in Menominee, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hi.
How can we help?
So I was wondering, you were talking about olive oil a couple weeks ago, and the health benefits of olive oil. But I was wondering, when you heat it up, like in a pan, when most people cook with it, does it lose any of its nutrient benefits?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, whenever you heat up any product at all, some of the nutrient benefits sort of disappear with heating. So it's just a natural thing. When we heat up, for instance, fruits and vegetables, especially vegetables in a pan, they lose some of their vitamins because they go away.
So the answer is yes.
The answer is yes.
Next caller.
It's not exactly. It's not exactly.
Well, is there like a certain temperature you should heat it to?
No. The issue with olive oil is we know olive oil is good because people who have a more Mediterranean diet cook with olive oil, have less heart attacks and strokes. So I don't think we really understand what's in the olive oil that does it. We know from studies that it really does make a difference in terms of, in terms of outcomes. So I don't think we can really, look at that and say, well, heat it to a certain temperature, it does this, another temperature, it does that. So what I would do is I would just have some of my olive oil, if I'm going to cook with it, I cook with olive oil. That's my oil of choice. And then if I make a salad dressing, I use olive oil. That's my that's my oil of choice. And I would just make a mixture. The higher the heat, I would generally think the more it would break down. But the fact is, I don't have any evidence for that. So I don't think it matters. We know that people along the Mediterranean Sea in Italy and France and Spain, in Lebanon and in Israel, everyone along the Mediterranean Sea uses lots of olive oil because, frankly, it grows there. That's where their traditional diet came in. And we know they have less heart attacks and strokes than we do, and we know that the recent study published in the New England Journal of Medicine showed the importance of the Mediterranean diet. So I would say cook with it, use it raw both ways.
Can we surmise, without any real research, that whatever nutrients are lost would be negligible?
I think so because basically we know that eating, you're not – people who are thinking of a Mediterranean diet are going to have it raw in their salads and are going to have it cooked when they cook with it. So I think the variety is the issue there. Do you use olive oil for most of your cooking?
Yeah, that's the only thing I use.
Yeah, that's exactly – so how long have you been using olive oil, would you say?
I guess – ever since I moved out and started cooking for myself, eight years ago.
I think that's really what it is. When I think back to what my mother used Crisco, and Crisco, solid Crisco, which was white, and then she used a generic Crisco called Spry, S-P-R-Y, and I still have this image of her. She'd take a great big glob of this and put it in the pan because there was no concept back in the 50s of good oil and bad oil, and that oil was bad for us. So yes, olive oil in moderation, wonderful to use, and basically, in moderation means 2 to 4 ounces a day would be good. Okay.
Okay, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate the call. Thank you. 800-462-7413.
So what did your mother cook with?
Probably the same stuff.
Crisco, do you remember that white stuff? It would be in a can?
I don't remember very, very well.
We'd have a great big can. It looked like a coffee can. She'd put it in the refrigerator, and everything we ate was fried.
Yeah.
You know, well, we didn't have fried Twinkies, but we had fried everything
else. My mother didn't fry that much.
Your mother didn't fry that much? So she...
She had the slow cooker.
Yeah.
And she had a pressure cooker.
And that was it.
Well, she must have fried, but I don't have no
memory. You don't have any memory. Yeah. See, so you lived in a non-fry household.
Well,
I lived in a fry everything household.
Also, I was in another room and my mother was cooking and I didn't pay a whole lot of attention. I was not a good son. 800-462-7413. It's toll-free. 800-462-7413. And now, Zorba, let's see if we can help a listener in Amherst, New York. Hi.
Hello.
What's up?
My question is about the quality of vitamin supplements. I take a 2,000-unit vitamin D soft gel and 500 milligrams of vitamin C daily, which I buy in big box stores and online.
Mm-hmm.
Does the quality of vitamins D and C differ much across these type of brands, or are they all pretty much the same, and are the dosages pretty accurate?
Good question. So first of all, do you buy the house brand? Where do you buy? What's the brand that you buy? I mean, you don't have to name the brand.
At Target, I get their Up and Up is the house brand.
Okay.
There's also the Puritan Pride online. There's Kirkland and some of those. I can't remember
Kirkland,
what the house brand is at Walmart.
Kirkland is the standard brand for Costco. So a couple things about this. First of all, a great website if you ever want to check your vitamins or anything else is consumerlab.org. That's consumerlab.org. They are great. They're dynamite. They charge. So in other words, you actually will have to pay for the information because they don't take any advertising at all. And they do a total analysis of all vitamins. Vitamins and supplements. So what you do is you look up your brand for that, and they'll tell you whether or not it actually met the number of milligrams, because that's a really good question. If it says 1,000 milligrams, the feds allow you to be, I think it's 20% above and below it. So 1,000 milligrams can be 800 milligrams or 1,200 milligrams. They check it out and see how many milligrams are actually in there. So when you're picking a supplement, one recommendation I have is go to Consumer Labs. You can also go to Consumer Reports. They report on some supplements. Use the brands they recommend, and then you know it's been tested by a third party. That's the absolute easiest, sort of the best, in many ways, we'll say the gold standard way of doing it. Another way of doing it is to look at the house brand of the vitamin. Costco, Walmart, Walgreens, CVS, all of the large companies, if they have their brand name on it, they don't want their name to be tarnished. In other words, so Costco is going to make sure they're essentially contracting with a superior company, a company that's going to be good, that's going to use quality control. And a Costco vitamin, on the whole, is going to be okay. Now, Puritan's Pride, Happy Valley Vitamins, pretty label vitamin products that you pay $20 to $25 a month for, generally 4 to 6 times what you would pay for a generic. To me, what you're buying is the packaging. I don't know if those vitamins are any better. And in fact, if you look at consumerlabs.org, you'll find out some of them that charge a lot of money do not have the value. The other value that I find with this website, as you can see, I like it, is they tell you how much it costs per milligram of vitamin. So in other words, they'll tell you what the best buy is based on that. Because a consumer, you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, as I said, you may be paying for a vitamin that doesn't have the potency and costs more. So I think on the whole, because you bought Kirkland, which is a Costco brand, I would say the chances are you're getting a good quality. But if you really want to check it, it's consumer labs.
2,000 milligrams for vitamin D?
2,000 a day. I used to recommend 1,000. Now I'm recommending 2,000. I think 2,000 a day is good for D. And I'm still recommending D. See, the evidence is paltry. God bless, may he rest in peace, Linus Pauling, who was a Nobel Prize winner in two places. Chemistry was either chemistry and physics, and it was a piece. So he got two Nobel Prizes. And as many people who are so highly intelligent, he believed that if he believed something, it was true. And he believed that vitamin C was wonderful and started a whole, if you will, industry on vitamin C because we all loved Linus Pauling in those days. But in the end, he was wrong. The data is paltry. It doesn't do much.
Okay.
Good luck, and keep taking those vitamins. Certainly D, for sure.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
Appreciate the call. Thanks. And before our next call, Zorba, we talk some about barefoot running.
Barefoot running. Have you ever seen the barefoot runners or the people in the minimalist shoes? So their little toes stick out. You know, I mean, they don't look like they have shoes at all. You know,
I've never noticed
that. Oh, you never noticed that? Yeah. Oh, well, obviously you don't run. You're not on the running track. But I see it when I go to the university and I'm up there. You have a regular running shoe, which is a pad in the heel. Mm-hmm. And then you have the minimalist shoes where you actually see the toes. And the concept behind minimalist running shoes or running barefoot mm-hmm. is that you will land on the forefoot versus landing on the heel.
In other words, is that good?
Well, that's the question that's all along. And it has nothing to do really with injuries, but the question is one giving you a better stride when you're actually competing? In other words, is landing on the forefoot better from a point of view of the muscles in the forefoot, the cushioning in the forefoot, the oxygen in the forefoot? Is that superior to landing on the heel, which is what we do with our
regular shoes? Well, you'd think there would be an injury question on there, too. Well, one must
be
better than the
other. But injuries are not the primary issue because people run differently. In other words, so you can have injuries in both. Oh. But the issue is not that one produces less injuries, does one give you an advantage mm-hmm. when you're running competitively? And there were a number of studies that were done. There are two studies that were done that looked at the data. And it turned out that heel striking, the traditionally way we run when we are running shoes, is physiologically more economical than running and starting, if you will, the thrust with the forefoot.
Does that mean you run faster?
Yeah, you've got an advantage there. I mean, yeah. The whole point physiologically is you have an advantage. Okay. Now, this goes against the present running literature where a lot of runners believe that barefoot running is better. You know, that it's actually physiologically better, and it undermines some traditional beliefs about minimalist running shoes. But it really goes with multiple studies that show traditional running shoes with the heel strike is better than the forefoot. So here we have two – it's interesting if you're a runner. We've got two views, minimalist shoes – regular shoes, mm-hmm. okay? And we've now shown physiologically that the regular shoes with the heel strike are probably better. But here it is. You believe your minimalist shoes are better, and you're both in a race.
Yeah.
Who's going to do better?
Well, you both have the same level of belief.
Well, that's exactly it. You hit the final point. The level of the belief probably counts more than the shoe. That's exactly it. You hit it. You got it right there. In other words, if you feel your shoe is going to make you win and you can get out there and do that, you're probably going to give that extra oomph, which is really going to give you that extra advantage because your shoes are better, even though physiologically the studies show one shoe might be superior to, and one way of running might be superior
to
the other.
Through my life, I thought I was going to win a whole lot of times when I didn't win. not necessarily in running, but in other activities.
Yes, but you know, if you don't try, you don't win.
Got it. 800-462-7413. And now Zorba, an Oak Ridge, Tennessee listener, joins us. Hi.
Hi. I'd love to know what Dr. Pastor thinks about the health risks of veganism, particularly in younger females.
Uh-huh.
I mean, teens and early 20s.
Mm-hmm. So why are you concerned?
Well, a member of my family has embraced veganism as though it were the Holy Grail.
Yes, that's right. That's exactly right. Right. So that's right.
Part of the belief system and the concern about these poor animals who are being killed for us people to eat.
Right.
And I am concerned because my understanding is these are the ages when skeletal formation is really important, and that skeleton's got to be there the rest of your life.
Mm-hmm. How old is this member of your family?
This one is 21.
Mm-hmm. 21. So this guy.
And I also read recently that calcium supplements are helpful, but most calcium should come from food, by all means.
Mm-hmm. Well, you bring up some very good points there. First of all, vegans tend to have an element of religiosity attached to their beliefs. In other words, that tends to be that.
And that's not necessarily bad.
Oh, by no means. By no means. I respect different belief systems. I think it's just, I mean, it's not my business. It's their business.
Yeah.
You know, absolutely. And there are more and more vegan restaurants because it's become more, I don't want to call it a fad, but it's, you know, it's an offshoot of vegetarianism, which has become more common in the U.S. Over the last number, the last number of years. It's hard when you go to a family. It would seem almost hard when you go to a family dinner because, you know, you almost have to cook separately for the vegans. But in the end, you often don't. I just was out in Colorado a number of months ago, and one of the skier's sons, because veganism tends to trend younger versus older, was a vegan, and we had no problems at all. We just made sure we made a number number of dishes, and usually he would eat one dish, and we would eat the other dishes in there. So from a point of view of making sure you get the right nutrients, I think as a vegan, you do have to be careful. I think you have to be careful for calcium, just like you said. Calcium by supplements, you can get that way. It's not as good as calcium in dairy products, but it's still good. So you're still going to get something. And there are a number of dark green vegetables that have calcium in there, and you can look through the dark green vegetables, accent that. But I think a calcium supplement is an excellent way to do it. As far as the other benefits, you know, vegans often will have a lower LDL, which is a bad cholesterol. They might have a higher HDL or a good cholesterol just because they're eating less animal fat. They're not eating any animal fat. So on the whole, that's going to be, if you will, physiologically better. On the other hand, we don't have any evidence that the vegan diet is going to be any difference from a point of view of heart attack, stroke, or cancer than a vegetarian diet or than a Mediterranean diet, you know, which once again allows small amounts of meat and encourages fish and some dairy products. So we don't have any evidence that one is better than another. So I think you can go back to your 21-year-old and say, just make sure you're getting calcium, or maybe during Christmas time, give him a bottle or two of calcium to take, you know, from you. So now, are you a vegan yourself?
No, I do vegetarian 3 days a week.
3 days a week. So, I mean, that's a very, that's kind of, you know, that's.
Might be to a vegetarian, but.
Yeah, but that's a moderate way of doing things. I'm an omnivore. I pretty much eat everything. I don't eat insects unless I don't really know that there are insects in the food that I'm eating. But I pretty much eat everything. But there are different styles of eating. There was a book out about 5 years ago talking about the history of vegetarianism in Western culture. And it's not new at all. It stems back to around the 1600s when people started having a more vegetarian style. As more meat was available in Britain, people started embracing that other style. And veganism is just a more strict vegetarian type diet. So good luck. Calcium is the issue. You were right on the ball with that, and I congratulate you. And I think having a discussion with your 21-year-old is often good from both sides. It leads to that intergenerational interplay that's important in life.
Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks. We appreciate it. And before the break, Zorba, let's log into the Zorba Pastor on Your Health inbox and take a quick question from Jane in Scarsdale, New York. She writes, Dear Dr. Zorba, my daughter has always been cooler than me, but lately I can hardly understand a word she says. For example, recently she started eating something called chia seeds. But all I can think about are the chia pet plants that we used to see on TV. Are these really the same seeds, and are they really edible?
Well, first of all, seeds are edible. I mean, most seeds are edible. I don't know if they're the same seeds at all. When I think of chia, every Christmas it comes out, chia, chia, chia. Yeah. And I mean, those plants have been going on for at least 20 or 30 years. I don't know if those are the same seeds for that. But seeds, if you want to eat them, they're often nutritious. And I see no reason why you aren't going to want to, that you have to not eat chia seeds. I myself have never had chia seeds. I've never looked at chia seeds. I've never heard of chia seeds. And I, too, will think of chia, 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 which is the plant that has those little green things growing out of the
If your daughter were eating, wouldn't you say, why are you eating those chia seeds?
Well, I also might say, give me a bunch of those and see whether or not I like them. I think I would definitely try chia seeds. Yeah, I think. Wouldn't you try chia seeds?
I don't know. Why would I want to?
Well, you know what we need? We have to get some chia seeds. I think that's what we have to do. And we're going to try chia seeds on the air. We're going to do that
on the air
on one of our next broadcasts. We'll see what it's like.
We
don't want to have it on the air, chia seeds.
Have a point you're willing to cede? Just send your medical questions along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have a recipe coming up, a good one. We have more of your questions. They'll be good, too. Some more medical research to talk over. All right here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. Our toll-free number again, 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, we talk about your vanilla extract.
That's right.
The recipe is Zorba's vanilla extract.
Right. We have guest chef Zorba Pastor here interviewing Zorba Pastor on Zorba's vanilla extract.
Yeah.
I love vanilla, and I like to use it as a flavoring in a whole bunch of different things. I was impressed by how expensive vanilla is. You know, good vanilla is expensive. First of all, you can get artificial vanilla, and you know what it tastes like? Artificial vanilla.
Yep.
I mean, that is exactly what it tastes like. So then I put on my thinking cap and I said, hey, Zorba, why don't you go to the web? Uh-huh. And lo and behold, after I did some searching on the web, I found a company called Olive Nation. Have you ever heard of Olive Nation?
No. Uh-uh.
Neither have I. Guess what they mostly sell?
Olives.
That's right. Excellent. You know something? You are bright.
I am very bright.
Well, it turns out Olive Nation is a great source for Madagascar vanilla beans. I learned all about vanilla beans. There are two kinds. The Madagascar is the better kind. It has a smoky flavor to it. And they have 1 pound of Madagascar vanilla beans for $40. 1 pound is an enormous amount of vanilla beans.
It goes a long way.
You can get smaller amounts, but it turned out the 1 pound was the best thing. Lo and behold, I ended up getting a pound of vanilla beans. They came in the mail. I looked at it and I said, wow. And then I searched the web for various recipes and came up with this recipe, which is amazingly, outrageously simple. Mm-hmm. It's something that if you want to give away, this is a great thing to do. So I'm going to give some other recommendations. Let me wax nostalgic about this before.
Sure.
When you go to someone's house for dinner, what do you normally bring over?
Wine?
Yeah, bottle of wine. You often bring over a bottle of wine. You know what they say when you bring over a bottle of vanilla extract and set? They go,
wow!
That's right.
Yeah.
They go, wow. You go, this is homemade vanilla extract. Yeah. And you open up the bottle and they smell it because vanilla has this wonderful aroma. And they go, thank you. So you can make a bunch of bottles like this because it takes about 2 months for the extract to work. And then you bring it over to their house. Mm-hmm. Instead of a bottle of wine, it is cheaper than a bottle of wine and it's more personal than a bottle of
wine.
That's
really a good idea.
And it's really very nice.
Yeah.
And then you can get nice bottles. I went to World Market and got nice bottles. And then I actually went online and found the specialty bottle site, which we'll also put on the website. And I ordered a dozen bottles with wonderful little caps, the kind of their punchy caps that stay on. And so now I've got a bunch of vanilla extra.
Good ideas.
Yeah. It's very nice. And the whole house smells good when you're making it. So let's make it. It's a
deal.
Really good
let's
recipe.
Do it.
Okay. So you start out by getting your vanilla beans at a cheap place. I use Olive Nation. You start out with 5 vanilla beans. Okay.
Okay.
You want to get a bottle that's 4 to 6 ounces, so go buy a bottle.
Four to six ounce bottle.
That's what I would use. And either buy it online or go to a nice place. Mm-hmm. You want the bottle to look nice, okay?
Yeah.
And now you're going to slit the beans. So you take and you slit the beans. Now, when you slit them, you leave a 1/4 inch at each end, and you slit the bean down the middle, but not totally through so that it will open up like a little pocket, if you will.
Got it.
You put 5 beans in for every 4 ounces of vodka, okay? Mm-hmm. 5 beans. Do not go less than that or you will not have a great extract. So 5 beans for every 4 ounces of vodka. Now, ask me what vodka I use.
Whatever the cheapest vodka.
Well, I decided that I would go a couple of steps above. That's exactly. So I wasn't using, I think it's called Rail vodka, but I don't think you have to use like the $50 a bottle vanilla vodka.
Right.
I go for something that's like about 12 bucks a bottle, you know, kind of right in between Smirnoff. I use, and then I use somewhat below Smirnoff.
Mm-hmm.
So what you do is you stuff the bottle with 5 beans. You then pour the vodka in the bottle. You then cover the bottle. This is a very complex recipe.
Yeah.
You then put the bottle, kind of shake it up to make sure the beans, you want to get as much of the bean with the vodka as possible. So mm-hmm. I go all the way up to the cork. Then you put it in the cabinet. And you don't have to touch it for 2 months. I mean, but you're going to touch it before 2 months because you're going to want to see what's going on. So a few days later, you're going to go into it, open it up, and smell the vanilla.
So it has to age for a while. It
takes 2 months. That's right. It takes 2 months. You can get something in 1 month, but basically there's still alcoholic, and you want to get rid of the alcohol smell, which goes away in about 2 months, and everything has been extracted for about 2 months. And then you've got a wonderful gift, and you've got the best vanilla extract you have ever tasted for cooking or anything else. It is dynamite.
Yeah. How does the vodka affect the taste?
Well, that's vanilla extract is an alcohol product. That's what it is.
But so what if you didn't
use put in a teaspoon or a tablespoon. First of all, if you're cooking, the vodka itself is going to go off with
the cooking. Well, that's what I'm thinking. Could you what purpose does it serve?
The vodka is the thing that extracts the seed, extracts it from the seed.
Okay.
Now, if you're looking at something like a vanilla bean ice cream, which we can find a recipe and put on, you're not going to use the vodka to the extract. But what you're doing is you're making an extract of the vanilla bean, and that's what it's mostly used for.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. So once again, you're not going to consume the whole bottle, which is 256 calories, which we have here. But it's a wonderful thing to bring to people's houses. I highly recommend it. If you want this recipe.
Let's put it on the web.
So go to ZorbaPastor.org, and while you're there, you can look at this recipe, all of our other wonderful recipes. You can look at Tom. You can look at I.
You can look at I.
I wasn't able to finish that. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook. And if you like us on Facebook, you know what you get? A good feeling in your heart.
I was trying to think of something, and I couldn't think of anything.
You know what? I had never seen you dumbfounded, but you were dumbfounded.
I was trying to think of what you get. One 800-462-7413 is our toll-free number. That's 800-462-7413. Back to the phones now, Zorba. We welcome a listener in Columbus, Ohio. Hi. How can we help?
Well, for the past several years, I've become very sick whenever I travel, and it's about a four-hour drive from my home to all of my friends and family. And whenever I make one of these trips, whether I'm traveling alone or with my husband, I'm fine during the drive itself. But 3 to 4 hours after I've arrived, I'll start to vomit, and then I'll get a migraine, and these will just increase in severity. And this will last for anywhere from 24 to 48 hours. And then after that, I'll be able to function again. And the rest of the trip will go fine. And when I travel back home, it doesn't happen. But my question is, what would cause such a sickness to suddenly start, you know, when I'd never had any problems traveling before? And could I do anything before or during the drive present it?
Whoa.
I practically stopped traveling.
That seems so strange. It happens one way, but it doesn't happen the other way.
Right. Not going home. Only toward the destination.
Does this always happen only with that one destination or when you go anywhere?
When I go anywhere. Mm-hmm. So it's not just a one person's house.
Oh, okay.
Sure, sure. I think you're getting migraines. That's what I think this is.
I do suffer from migraines.
Yeah, I think it's a migraine variant. And let's look at it from that point of view, you know, migraine variant.
Okay.
So first of all, coming home is different in our brain. You know, we're coming home. We're going home. We're relaxed. We're going home. We get into our own bed and everything. Going somewhere else can be, it's different. We think of it differently. I mean, all you have to do is think about how when you travel in a car to someone's place, let's say you're going a few hours, going there seems longer than coming home, right? We've all had that experience.
Yeah.
Going there is long. Coming home is short. We know it's exactly the same distance. And yet we're psychologically in a different place between both things. So what I think is happening, I don't know why, but you are triggering off a migraine and a migraine variant. So for 2 days, you're vomiting, you're nauseous, you have all the migraineur symptoms. And what we have to do is treat the migraine. We can treat it prophylactically in a variety of ways, and I think that's actually going to solve this. That's what I think it is. Why it's happening before you're going versus coming home, I don't know, but psychologically, as I said, things are different. So I have a couple of very specific suggestions. First of all, when we look at prevention of migraines, there are a number of drugs that help prevent migraines that we give to people. We give them beta blockers. A drug called Inderol, that's the name brand. The generic is very common. If that did not work, I would try Imitrex. And that's,
I have an Imitrex prescription.
I would try Imitrex. But I think I'd try the beta blocker first. That may be there. Then there are other things you can try that also work for migraine. There's an old-fashioned drug called Periactin. And Periactin is an antihistamine that sometimes works for migraines, sometimes works for cluster headaches. And because it's an antihistamine, it may also work to help the vomiting. Periactin is another old-fashioned drug. And what I would do with your doctor is I would go through one drug after another to find out whether or not a reduction in migraines is going to reduce this. Because, like you said, you've stopped traveling because of this. And the reality is, I think it's a I think you're getting migraines. That's what I think it is.
Oh, okay. I will definitely follow that up with my doctor. Thank you.
Yeah.
You're welcome.
Good luck.
You're welcome.
1-800-462-7413. Ann Zorba, a listener with us now in Sault Ste. Marie, Michigan. Hi.
Hi, Tom. Hi, Dr. Zorba.
What's up?
During the holidays, I encountered a family member who was very enthusiastic about the idea that we should eat according to our blood type. She had had some stomach issues, and she said that when she read, I don't even remember the name of the book, when she read this book, and she changed her diet according to her blood type, it made a huge difference. And before I started examining a million websites and started reading a million books, I thought I'd check in with an impartial, informed opinion on the subject. So is there some validity to the idea that we should regulate our diets according to our blood types?
I think you have a one-word answer for that.
No.
Oh, really?
That's the one-word answer, no. You know, I'll tell you, the guy who wrote that book, he made a gazillion dollars. You know, eat to your blood type. So O people should eat differently than B negative people and A positive people. Eat to your blood type because it really makes a difference. And everyone loses weight and people are happy and they get rid of depression. They're no longer anxious. Life is good. Human relationships are better. There's no cancer. There's no heart disease at all in the world. And you live to be 900 like Methuselah. It is hooey. It doesn't do a thing. Now, it is true that the placebo effect is very, very high when eating to your blood type. So people who are O positive, which is about half the population, and when they eliminate foods, you know, maybe foods that begin with the letter C or the letter D because they're eating to their blood type, they say they feel much better. And, you know, that particular effect, the placebo effect, that generally lasts for about 2 weeks to 6 months. And after about 6 months, the placebo effect goes away. So some people will stick to it, but 99% of the people who start a diet like eat to your blood type are not on it 2 years later. It's actually 95% and above. I misspoke when I said 99%. It's 95%. So call back in another year and let us know if she's still eating to her blood type or she's on something else. But no, it's of all the diets that are out there, I would say this one has the most quackery, quack, quack, quack that's attached to it. And you know what? I will get letters from people now who eat to their blood type and believe that it really does make a difference. And for them, because they are eating differently and because they have a belief that they're eating differently, it really does make a difference. And I really respect that because I really respect what the human mind does when it comes to actually making good lifestyle choices to make yourself live a longer, sweeter life. So I do believe that it's of use to them.
Oh, I see. Okay. Well, it sounds like I made the right call as the first call before I spent hours investigating on the Internet. So.
Exactly. Thank you so much for your call.
Thank you.
Yep. Bye-bye. And before we take a quick break, Zorba, let's help out a nervous nail biter in Jackpot, Nevada. Jackpot.
Yeah. You know what? I've been to Jackpot.
Have you?
Yes, I've been to Jackpots. I think I sent a letter from Jackpots. Yes, I've been to Jackpot, Nevada.
Susanna.
Not a very big town, by the way.
I can believe that because I've never heard of it.
Yep.
Susanna is known for her gnawing but wants to make a change. She writes, "Hi, Doc. Ever since I can remember, I've suffered from the chronic desire to destroy my nails. I've tried every trick in the proverbial book, fake nails, bad-tasting polish, even Band-Aids on every finger, but nothing works. I've heard that the constant chewing will make my nails brittle for life, and I'm at my breaking point, pun intended. Do you have any last-ditch tips to help me out of this dilemma?"
Well, first of all, you know, you can destroy your nails by chewing them all the time, but very few people do it. I mean, if you look at nail biters, have you ever looked at the nail biter's nails?
They're very nail-bitten, yeah.
Yeah, they're nail-bitten.
They
they're
go
small,
way down.
They go way down, and, you know, not – it affects quite a lot of the population.
I did it as a kid.
Yeah, you nail-bite it as a kid.
Yeah.
Nail-bit.
Yeah.
Nail-bit as a kid. Please, grammar police, I changed what I said.
Right,
I didn't
right.
say nail-bite it. Yeah. I said nail-bit. Yeah. So don't send in those, those grammar things. You know, the things you try are just what she tries, putting stuff on that, trying to make it taste worse. There are psychologists, there are clinicians that work on this and can get people away from this obsession. There are medications you can take for the obsession, but you have to take them every single day, and it's not something I would certainly recommend. Yeah. Why do you want to take a pill every day? I think it would be better to bite your nails than to take something. But sometimes taking the pill for 3 to 6 months, along with a psychologist that deals with this, can allow you to get to the other side of that and to be able to get some control over your compulsions, because that's what it is. It is a compulsion. So I would recommend, A, talking to your doc about a referral to a clinical psychologist who specializes in compulsions, and I would either consider cognitive behavioral therapy, CBT, for this, with or without a depressant, antidepressant that has been approved for obsessive compulsive disorder, and work with that, and you may be able to get to the other side. Clearly, it's disturbing to you, and it's not something to make fun of. It's a really serious thing to the person who bites their nails. It just is a compulsion, and you've got to work on it to get rid of it.
I can't remember as a kid how I got rid of that habit.
A lot of people do it. I chewed on pencils. I used to love, in fact, when I think about it now, it brings back memories of elementary school chewing on pencils. Yeah. I would love to chew off all that yellow stuff.
I think with me it was kind of a mind over matter, just saying, I'm going to really try.
Well, you could do it. And it wasn't a compulsion for you. In other words, maybe it was a compulsive behavior.
It seemed
very
compulsive.
You could get to the other side. But adults who have this compulsion, it is a serious thing. And there are lots of them out there where they would like to stop, and they just can't get that mind over it. And once again, clinical psychologists who specialize in this can do a dynamite job.
We'll need to nail down the solution to a harmful habit. Just send your concerns along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
We have some interesting medical research to talk about. That's coming up. More of your calls, too. And, of course, our medical myth buster all later on, right here on Zorba Pastor and Your Health from PRI, Public Radio International. Tom Clark with Family Doc Zorba Pastor here on Zorba Pastor on Your Health. That toll-free number is 1-800-462-7413. But before our next call, Zorba, some talking about drinking and driving and about teen driving, too.
Right. So designated drivers. You know, it's become a cultural norm. You know, people who go out
and go in a group and
one person is the designated driver. And so this was a study looking at designated drivers to see how much alcohol they had actually drank, you know, sort of assume the designated driver doesn't drink. Well, it turns out in a lot of cases it's not, you know, numb. In this particular study, they conducted it over a 3-month period at a variety of places. Only 65%, so 2 out of 3 showed no blood alcohol. Okay, so for 2 out of 3,
a third were drinking?
Yeah, a third were drinking. So let's look at that third that was drinking. 17% registered 0.02%. That's a very small number.
Yeah.
You know, that's a small number, to 0.049%. So in other words, the Highway Association recommends that once you're at 0.05%, you shouldn't be driving. So 17% were at this sort of lower number. But 18%, these are that, were actually higher. So in other words, around 18% of the designated drivers in the study were 0.05% or higher. So according to the National Highway Safety Administration, they shouldn't be driving.
Right.
It's 18%. So in other words, 20% of the designated drivers shouldn't be driving. And then roughly about, you know, that's 18% roughly, and around 17% have had a bit of alcohol, but not too much. So 1 out of 5, 20%, 1 out of 5 of the designated drivers shouldn't be driving at all.
So cut it out if you're a designated
driver. Right. In other words, if you're a designated driver, that means you're a designated driver. You got to take it seriously. You have to look at these things and say, what am I doing? I have to do this seriously.
Well, how about now teens?
Well, teens are a whole different, you know, you remember when you were a teenager. I know it's in the distant past. I certainly do. And teens are doing an awful job. 40% of the teenagers in this recent study said they have driven under the influence of alcohol. But being teenagers, they claim that the alcohol either made no difference or improved their driving ability.
Yeah, yeah.
In other words, no, I concentrate more when they're on alcohol. Yeah. 95% of the teens, by the way, say they're cautious drivers. In other words, they all say they're cautious drivers.
Well, I didn't do any of that as a teen, but I was pretty dumb as a teen.
Yeah,
so are
these
teens.
Cautious drivers. Now, more concerning is that 75% of the teens have driven under the influence of marijuana and believe that has no impact at all and that it actually makes them better drivers. Now, when you put into the fact that 3,000 teenage driving deaths occur every year in America, you realize, A, we have to make the designated driver the real designated driver, and B, if you're a teen, don't drink and drive and don't smoke weed and drive either.
1-800-462-7413, our toll-free number. Back to the phones now, Zorba, as we welcome a listener in Cross Plains, Wisconsin. Hi.
Hello.
How can we help?
Well, we live west of Madison, and we have a well. The water's very acidic and very high in iron, so we have a softener that deals with both those problems.
Mm-hmm.
But so all the water that comes into the house is softened, and we're wondering if that's safe to drink or cook with.
Well, first of all, there's sodium in there. What you're doing with a water softener is you're substituting sodium for calcium, and that's basically what a water softener does. You put in all that salt, and that's what's going on. And the water you cook with and drink shouldn't be softened. You know, I mean, it's always considered what you don't need that extra sodium, and you're getting more sodium that you need. And sodium, we know, is associated with high blood pressure, and that's why we try to cut salt out of it. So, have you looked at the pipes in your house to see whether or not it's
salt? We had this really efficient water softener. We had a lot of brown water because the acid was hard on the copper pipes.
So it also goes through the water and the sink in your kitchen.
Yes, every faucet is soft.
So, you know, my recommendation on the whole with stuff like that is not to drink softened water. I mean, it's not going to hurt you to drink every so often, but you're getting more sodium than you need to have. That basically is. Now, I've been living in the country. I have a well, as do our number of our neighbors. And in our house, the sinks at the bottom of the house do not have softened water. So the bathroom sink on the first floor and the sink on the kitchen sink on the first floor do not have softened water. Don't you notice the difference in the taste of softened water?
Oh, yeah, I don't like it.
Yeah.
Well, we don't drink it. We buy water. We've been buying water for 15 years.
Oh, so you buy water. It's not drinking the occasional softened water is not going to bother you. I mean, when I'm upstairs with my upstairs bathroom, I have a water softened water. I don't go downstairs and get a glass of water when I'm thirsty because, frankly, I'm too lazy and I just don't do it. It's not going to bother me. I just don't like the taste of it. But as long as you're drinking bottled water, that's what I would do.
Yeah, so, I was thinking it would be nice not to have to haul water.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would. This is one of the joys and adventures of living in the country, isn't it?
Thanks for taking my question.
You're welcome. Yeah. Thank you for calling.
Thanks so much for the call at 800-462-7413. And before our next call, Zorba, let's gear up for another medical mythbuster. This one comes to us from Henri, H-E-N-R-I. That'd be Henri, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, H-E-N-R-I might be Henry. You think it's Henri?
Well, no, I think it's Henri.
Okay. Well, you know something? I bet we'll find out.
Henri, let us know.
I bet we'll find out. We will have people who chime in on our pronunciation. They're called the chime-in police.
He's in Miami Beach, Florida, and he's a new dad who needs some help containing contagion.
Okay.
He writes, Dear Dr. Z, I recently heard from a notable source, a.k.a. I read it on the Internet. That if I share spoons with my son, I could risk giving him one of my many cavities. Is this true? Could my candy consumption harm more than just my health?
Well, you know, at one level, the answer is it's true, because there turns out there are bacteria in the mouth called Streptococcus mutans, M-U-T-A-N-S, which are associated with cavities. And the reality is when you develop some intimacy with your child, like, you know, you take a spoonful of food and they do, you're actually, if you've got that in your mouth, as most of us do, you're increasing the risk that your child
may have
cavities.
Must be just a little tiny bit of it.
Well, that's what I mean. I mean, the reality is we do lots of things with our kids. Who doesn't share a spoon with their child? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, that's bonding. So at one point, you know, there might be a risk of cavities. Go to the dentist. Don't feed them candy. Make sure they brush your teeth. And the other side is, oh, I'm not going to eat anything you're going to eat because I may do some contagiousness. Well, what is that for being a dad and bonding? I mean, come on. When I had my kids and they were young, we would share ice cream cones. They take a lick. Yeah. I take a lick. I'm really going to worry about the fact that I may transmit a theoretical Streptococcus mutans to their mouth. That would be a little obsessive, and it wouldn't be fatherly. So my recommendation, keep sharing food with your children, with your child, rather. It's a bonding experience. It's fun. And make sure that when he's the right age, bring him to the dentist.
Have a myth for Zorba. He's armed to the teeth with answers.
That's very
good.
Just
send your debates along in an email to
Zorba@WPR.org.
800-462-7413. It, of course, is toll-free. And a listener with us now, Zorba, in Pine Hills, New Mexico. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Fine. How can we help?
Oh, I have a question. My daughter was told that it was better for her digestion if she would take soluble fiber versus, I guess, what is called dietary fiber. So I've been looking at all these boxes, you know, the labels for the difference between dietary fiber, soluble fiber, and I'm wondering why soluble fiber is so different and why is it better for you than perhaps dietary fiber?
Uh-huh. Well, first of all, they both come through food. So they're really both dietary. And I don't know if one's really better than another. The idea for this came through the concept that Metamucil, which is a sort of soluble fiber, when you take Metamucil, which is the fiber of psyllium seed, so it's a flour that's made from psyllium seed, mm-hmm. and you drink it down, that increases the bulk in your stool and decreases the risk of colon cancer. And that's kind of where the theory came from. But it really came from the foods. People who eat more fiber, soluble and insoluble, appear to have less colon cancer. We think because it has an increased transit time through the colon. Think is the word. We're not actually quite sure. We know colon cancer is a dietary issue. So for a long time, the theory was that soluble fiber was better than bran. Bran is a good example of insoluble fiber, or as my wife Penny calls it, donkey food, because it doesn't really taste like anything. I haven't given it to donkeys, and we don't have donkeys in the house. Donkey food.
Tell that to my wife, who loves bran and eats it all the time.
Well, you go home, and you tell Monica, we call this donkey food, and see what she
says. Actually, I don't know if she loves it, but she does eat it all the time.
She may not. Well, that's because she probably puts sugar. Does she eat sugar on? Does she put sugar or anything on it to make it taste like something?
Maybe honey every now and then.
Honey. That's right. That's exactly, because you know what it tastes like? Donkey food. That's exactly what it tastes like. I agree. So that's insoluble fiber. So the answer kind of is both. You know, that means high fiber foods are good for you and things like bran. But I don't think there's really evidence that one is superior. Now, there are other things that fiber give you. It turns out that fiber, foods that are high in fiber, carbohydrates, tend to reduce the risk of diabetes, or at least are not associated with the risk of diabetes from high glycemic index foods. High glycemic index foods shoot out sugar suddenly into your body. The best example is sugar. You know, honey is also a high glycemic food, whereas a potato with the skin will have more fiber from the skin. An apple with the skin will have more fiber, too, and some of that fiber is insoluble, the skin itself.
Oh, that's good. That's good to know. Mm-hmm. And on your bran topic, I love bran, but I make it with rhubarb and muffins.
Ah, you see, that's exactly it. So you're eating your donkey food with something that's tasty.
Exactly.
That's the way to make it work. Thanks for your call.
Thanks a lot. Appreciate it.
Bye. You're welcome.
And before we head out, Zorba, let's squeeze in another case of Judge Zorba.
Okay, wait a minute. Got to get my gavel. Man. There it is. I've got it. I'm going to pull out the gavel, and I've got it in my hand.
Do judges have to search around and open up a box before they just...
Well, when they start the day, I don't have my robes either. That's true. That's really my robes.
Anyway, Kim in Suffolk, Virginia wants some help handling a dispute about hearing that she's having with her husband. She writes, "Dear Dr. Zorba, I'm finally taking my health seriously and working out almost daily. I actually like it more than I thought I would, just as long as I have music. My husband is worried that the earbuds I use at the gym will make me deaf, but I can't imagine exercising with chunky retro headphones. What do you think? Am I harming my hearing, or is the hyperventilating about nothing?"
If the music is too loud, you're harming your hearing, period. That's what it is. It's how loud the music is. Once you get to 60 to 80 decibels, then you're harming your hearing. Now, it used to be hard to measure the amount of sound coming out of
the earbuds.
Yeah. But you can actually do it with a iPhone and the decibel meter. So you can put the decibel meter next to your iPhone and see how loud it actually is. And you can actually measure it. Not very accurate, but at least it'll give you the idea.
Yeah.
You know, the problem is when you're at a gym and you're exercising, it's noisy because the treadmill's noisy. And so you got to pump it up. Mm-hmm. And you just have to be careful because the answer is yes. Loud music destroys hearing, and you got to be careful when you know as you use it.
So just keep it as soft as you.
Well, you want to keep it soft. You want to keep it loud enough so that you can hear it, but soft enough so it's not causing you harm. Precisely.
Mm-hmm. Think your spouse's facts are phony? Just send your debates along to the judge
in an email to Zorba at WPR. That was mygavel.org.
Deciding in favor of the husband.
That's right. Of course. I don't always side with the husband. I'll get into trouble for that. I take it back.
In any case, see you next week, Zorba.
Stay well, Tom.
If you missed anything during the show or just want to download our show podcast, visit us on the web
at zorbapastor.org. And don't forget, you can find us on Facebook.
And don't forget, you can call us anytime, too, at 800-462-7413. Zorba Pastor on Your Health is a production of Wisconsin Public Radio. It's not intended as a medical diagnosis, so please do check with your doc. This show was produced by Gabrielle Pedriani. Our executive producer is Adam Friedrich, and our technical director is Brad Colbert. Our theme music is by Leon Van Sidren. For Zorba Pastor, I'm Tom Clark, hoping that you'll be with us for the next Zorba Pastor on Your Health.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0629Z. More information on Zorba, his clinic, and healthy living, including heart-healthy recipes, podcasts, and show archives, is available online at zorbapastor.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.